Hey guys, welcome to this week's episode of Untucked. Today we're going to talk about a podcast interview with two pretty prominent people in the financial services world, Michael Kitsis and Jason Zweig. And they talk about really a lot of things, the role of the advisor, the evolution of the financial advising business and profession. So we spend a bit of time on that. Then we're talking about NFTs, non-fungible tokens. There's been a lot of discussion around that in kind of the media recently. So we comment on it. And then we will wrap up with a discussion around optimism, pessimism, realism, and kind of the conflict that that all three of those things are at in a lot of people. Thanks for listening. Enjoy. The opinions expressed on this podcast are our own, and they do not reflect the opinions or views of FC Advisory, the Financial Coach Group, or the New Wealth Project. Nothing discussed on this podcast should be interpreted as investment advice. Welcome to episode 48 of Untucked. This is Megan.
And Mike.
And this is Jeff. So it's probably not hard to understand that some of these terms go back to like nautical roots, like taken aback and loose cannon and high and dry. But the term by and large actually goes back to like the 16th century, where the word large was used to mean like if you were sailing a ship, the wind was like at your back, large. And by was talking about the wind was in your face. So if you said like by and large, they were referring to like going through the seas in like any and all directions relative to the wind. But today we use a term like by and large for like all things considered, or like for the most part. Like it has no relation to where the terminology really came from.
So give me a sentence, Jeff, where by and large is used correctly.
I was traveling from the United States to Spain. And by and large, it was a tumultuous journey.
Okay.
I wasn't prepared to give an example. Wow. Sorry.
I feel like you did a lot of research for this fun fact.
Not much. I'm actually very wildly amused by where like sayings come from. You know what I mean?
Really?
Yeah.
I do. I don't know how anyone or why anyone would be wildly amused by it, but I know what you mean.
Yeah.
Okay.
Cool.
It's
been a while. What do we have Philly sports wise?
Carson Wentz got traded.
Haven't had a pod since Carson got traded.
We talked about it like three times. Phil started a Grapefruit League.
Pitchers and catchers reported.
Yeah. No, I don't have anything on the Phillies yet.
We got anything on the Flyers?
Just that they had a little break for COVID. A bunch of people were in COVID protocol, so they had to postpone like a week's worth of games. They resumed, I don't know, I guess a week ago. Had a good weekend, and then now they're in the middle of playing Pittsburgh three times in a row in like five nights. So their record's good. They've got all their guys back, and on paper, and also the way I think they're playing more recently, they're in good shape. Carter Hart questions are there for sure, though. He's having an average. He looks average, not awesome. Like the expectation is, he's letting in, I think, too many softies, routinely.
Are we gonna have to roll the tapes to my comment a few episodes ago when I said to you, Carter Hart, like I feel like when he lets in a goal, he lets in six and he gets pulled from a game, and you quickly dismissed that as our resident hockey expert. And yeah, he has his – I'm not saying he's not a good goalie because I think he's an extraordinary talent. He's just really – I feel like he's really inconsistent. Like he has great games and then he has really bad ones. And he doesn't – I don't feel like he's put together like half a season where he's played well. And good goalies, and I'm saying that not watching every game as intensely as you are. So I'm not sure if it's accurate, but I feel like the, and this is probably a bad comparison or a bad analogy, but what's the Devils goalie that was like, he was the best goalie in
Brodeur?
Yeah, like the Marty Brodeurs of the world. They have good seasons.
He's like 20 years old though.
I know. That's,
and I don't think anybody's concerned other than like a lot of like Philly Flyers fans who are freaking out, like maybe you are a little bit, because I think the raw ability is cleared. Like, I don't think there's, and the mental toughness is there. I think he's already demonstrated that he's, any team in the league would take him in a heartbeat is what I guess what yeah. I'm saying. And Elliott has been awesome.
Has he? I haven't watched many games with
Ryan. And any team that's going to succeed in this crazy schedule with like pretty much a game every other night, which is insane to think about it, for a sport like hockey, needs two goalies to be able to get through it. And so that, for that reason, I think they're in a good position. I think they'll be there come playoff time. I think they'll be in it, and I think they're going to do some damage, or they certainly have the potential to. So I'm okay with it.
Do you think he just needs more time at this level to really get the pace of the game, get the speed of the game, get the talent level that these other players are playing at, and that's what he's just got to get used to? Or should no, that's already there. He should have that already. Like, what's holding this raw talent back?
There's a combination of poor defensive play in front of him that plays a role. I mean, you can't. It's not just,
not when it comes to softies.
He lets in a softie here or there, but he also makes unbelievable saves on a routine basis as well. So, like, you got to kind of. It's hard to evaluate. I think he's clearly he's underperforming his ability so far, but I think he'll get it back.
I watched a game the other night. I forget who they were playing. It was one of the Buffalo games when they were down 3-1. I think I saw Ivan Provorov like deflect a puck in front of Carter Hart. I almost texted you like
I know the player you're talking about. Yeah.
And there were two very specific plays where I almost picked up my phone and texted you like, is our defense trying to score on our goalie? Like, yeah. Provorov, get your body in front of the puck, deflecting a puck in front of your own goalie. Like, you're just asking to score on your own goalie.
Well, I mean, it's just a mistake. It was I mean, you're ripping on Provorov. Of all the guys, come on.
I don't understand you two. I don't understand you two how we're not allowed to be critical when our players make mistakes. I don't get it. I texted you last night. I said at the end of the fourth quarter, Joel Embiid's jump shot looked like he was tired, and you're like, don't be like that. Oh, I can't say that a player is fatigued.
He had a monster game. He's the reason they won. Like, in the in that moment, yeah, you're being a hater.
That's not being a hater. It's just saying, dude, he looked like he was tired. He needed a rest. You could tell his jump shot didn't have the form that it had earlier in the game. He was hitting the front of the rim. That means your shooter is tired. They just need a break. It didn't mean he had an awful night and he sucks and he's like, trade him. Why can't I say he looks tired? We all get tired. And he comes back and he shoots with 8 seconds left, a three-pointer to tie the game to send it to overtime. Like, crazy. Mm-hmm. Didn't think that shot was going in, by the way.
As soon as it left in hands, I was like, we're in overtime. No, I actually, my first thought was, shit, there's too much time on the clock. Because I was that confident that it was going to go in. And the Jazz just, were you done on the Flyers?
Yeah, we're good.
The Jazz just made every three-pointer they took last night.
That was unbelievable.
And I was just like, holy shit. Like, he's going to have this monster shot, and then they're going to come down and make another three and just end it. And they didn't. And then Tobias Harris played an awesome overtime, and they, the best team in the East, beat the best team in the league. And yeah, they go into All-Star break 26-12 or something.
Who did the Jazz lose halfway through the game in the fourth quarter? He got a Donovan Mitchell.
But that was an overtime. He got ejected.
Oh, was that an overtime?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They're having an All-Star game?
Yeah. They're having a dunk contest. They're having a three-point contest. They're having the skills competition.
Can every sport so just dumb. Do away with all-star games?
Couldn't agree more.
I mean, enough is enough.
You're saying that as a 50-year-old and a 30-year-old. I loved, when I was 12 years old, all-star games and dunk competitions and three-point. Like, that's – little kids live for that stuff, man.
Okay. This year should be the exception.
I agree
there
with that.
Should, like, in light of everything, the fact that the schedule is what it is, like, the Lakers played through, God, like, October of last year, started the season in January, and, like, LeBron has to play an all-star game.
It's stupid.
It's stupid.
I agree with that.
Yeah, and it's so different than the way it used to be. I think, for the most part, players were honored and psyched to be picked to play in an all-star game or an all-pro game. Now they're like, shit, I wanted a break. I need like a 3 or 4 day break.
Yeah.
You got to be kidding me.
I don't think that the All-Star games had much relevance in the past. Now they determine like home court advantage and things like that, don't they?
I don't think anymore.
That is stupid.
Yeah, I don't think anymore.
Baseball did it, right? Where
baseball
got home field.
I don't think the NBA ever did that. Okay. That was seeding.
All right. Yeah. I'm mistaken.
Yeah. I think that, like, the 7-time All-Star, 15-time is, like, the least relevant statistic on anybody's resume. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Because anybody's resume.
Excluding Ben Simmons.
Oh, God.
And then they had fans voting. I know in hockey they had fans voting. Like, it's so watered down and just who cares.
But even the media voting and, like, the other coaches voting, it's all stupid. Like, it's all too biased. I mean, Tobias Harris is not an all-star. He's playing out of his mind. He's on the best team in the East. And Ben Simmons is an all-star over him. And I'm talking shit on, like, the people on the team that I root for.
Yeah.
It's just stupid.
I have 2 points on the Sixers, if we can stay there for a second.
Sure.
One of them is, I think Doc Rivers is making Brett Brown look like a fool right now. I mean, he doesn't have that much different of a team, and he clearly motivated Tobias to have an unbelievable season so far. Joel Embiid as well, and you could probably argue a little bit Ben Simmons as well. So I think he's making Brett Brown look silly right now. Second point, if the Sixers can pull off a championship with Joel Embiid on their team, I think Joel Embiid goes down as like – the model athlete for Philadelphia sports. From the standpoint of this guy came into the league, got some criticism, was a bit of a goofball on Twitter, and just sucked it up, raised his game, and won a championship. And if that's not like, and then the city will absolutely take care of that guy for the rest of his life. Like that just, that lays the groundwork for other athletes. Like just man up and do that, and you will be taken care of forever. And I think that would be for Joel Embiid specifically, because I've given him some criticism in the past. Seeing him play this year, I would be super happy. Obviously, he's a Sixer fan, but also for him that he did it all without complaining, without shooting back at any of the fans or any of the media. Like, he's just handled it like an absolute pro.
Yeah, I don't think I disagree at all on the Joe stuff. I mean, I view him as maybe closer to being that guy already just because of his play this year. The championship obviously is icing on the cake, but like he has absolutely elevated his game and in turn elevated this team to a different level. So, yes. The Doc Brett comment is interesting to me because like, there was a point yesterday in the Jazz game where the Jazz had their two best players, Donovan Mitchell, who's a 2-time All-Star, and Rudy Gobert, who's like a 2-time Defensive Player of the Year, on the court. And the Sixers had an all-sub lineup, like all their bench players, which was done to spell the starters. And usually, like when two of the other team's best players come in, you send back in someone. It doesn't have to be Joe, Ben, and Tobias, but it's one of the three or two of the three. Doc let that sub lineup play for like probably 7 minutes when a lead of 2 for the Jazz went to a lead of 14. I was fuming because I was just like, and this is what he did in LA. He did not make rotation changes based on gameplay. He had at this minute, these guys are going to go in. At this minute, these guys are going to come out. And he did not modify until like the end of a close game. And I'm sitting there like, oh, this is LA. Like, we're in LA. Like, I'm a Clippers fan. And I'm like, obviously going way too far. And then Ben comes back in. He is like, Joe makes a layup. Ben finishes a layup. And quickly, 14 gets down to, you know, 8 or 10. And it like, it was obviously fine. But that's not the first time I've had that moment. And then I'm thinking about like, this is how Brett coached. Like, I agree that there's absolutely a motivating factor that exists with Doc. And I would say maybe it's Doc, maybe it's Maury, maybe it's just Ben, Joe, and Tobias agreeing that they don't want to be the, you know, out in the first or second round. And there's a lot of self-motivation coming from them. But the coaching, like the X's and O's basketball, is not that different. And that's not a knock on Doc. It's not a compliment to Brett. I just think like if you watch basketball casually, Doc's going to get more credit coaching than he probably deserves, which I'm fine. If it yields good results, I don't give a shit. But like, I don't know that the comment about it being Brett and Doc is totally accurate. I kind of feel like it's maybe the guys.
Yeah, I wasn't referring more to the X's and O's.
Yeah.
I was referring more to they're just – it's clear they're not getting away with – I'll put that in air quotes – with what they got away with Brett Brown. Like, Doc isn't going to take shit. You could tell that Doc, if you're not going to, like, play your heart out, you're going to sit. I think the motivational side of it is – and maybe it's they have more respect for him than they had for Brett.
That might be part of it, unfortunately. Yeah.
So the fact that this coach is getting more out of these players, I think, means a lot. And your 14-point or your 2-point lead to 14, they won the game. Maybe that's the genius of Doc. He let his boys rest. And then
God, don't do that. Because with this Sixers team, 14 turns into 28 in like a blink of an
really
eye.
It does.
So it could have went from bad to worse. It just, you know, happened not to last night. So All-Star break, couple games, couple days off. And then I texted Christian last night and I was like, my heart is not ready for the inevitable, like, lost 8 of their last 12. That's going to come out of All-Star break.
I hope not. Does hockey have a break?
No.
Are they doing an All-Star?
No way. All-Star. There's no chance. They'll be lucky to get all the games in that were scheduled because COVID's run through so many teams. It's going to be interesting to see if they can if all the teams play the same number of games, actually. It's going to be a challenge. I mean, it's 4 games in 7 days, like week after week after week. That's brutal.
Yeah, it's a lot.
No practice, you know? So
be interesting to roll with these two teams into the playoffs. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah. Coach's Corner.
What do we got?
This is the Financial Advisor Success Podcast, episode 216. This is a Michael Kitsis podcast. He had Jason Zweig from the Wall Street Journal on as a guest. The title of the episode is The Financial Advisor as a Curator and Redefining the Value of Financial Expertise. Michael and Jason cover a lot in this episode, such as the parallels between the fiduciary ethics of financial journalism, the evolution of the value proposition for financial advisors, and financial planning as a profession.
There's a lot to unpack here.
I hate that you said that, but there was a
it's
lot.
It's very long, like, yeah. And Jason Zweig, we've talked about him before. He writes that intelligent investor column for the Journal. He's been doing it for years, so many years. And I think he likes to say, look, I write the same 50 articles and no more. I just say the same thing a different way over and over and over again. Because number one, there's only so much to say about kind of personal finance and investing. And also the message is, you know, simple, long term, you know, all that kind of stuff. But he's very, very knowledgeable about the business of financial advice. And I thought it was interesting.
I don't know why I assumed he actually advised people at some point in his life.
No.
Yeah, he hasn't.
No, and I mean, it's kind of, because he's been very critical in the past of like the profession generally, the CFP board. And he's always said, at least everything I've heard or read of his is like, I know I'm saying this having never sat in that seat. So I like that approach. I mean, I think it's fair to be critical, but also being self-aware enough that the caveat comes with, I've never done it.
Was there anything, any specific kind of topic that they covered that you guys think deserves us discussing?
Well, I mean, the first part of it, they talked a lot about the concept of being able to say, I don't know, mm-hmm. which is something that a lot of advisors are like loath to say because they're afraid it makes them look either incompetent or like, what am I paying you for? But we talk about it around here all the time. I mean, when someone says, where's the market going or where's it going to be in a year or interest rates or anything, the correct answer is always, I don't know. Mm-hmm. Simple. And I think that Zweig made a point here where he's talking about, he goes, a lot of advisors think they know the answer to the questions, and they spend much of their day acting on their own predictions. And that's really true. Like that's just, a lot of people's value proposition is doing just that. And that is a worthless activity in my opinion. So that part of it, the I don't know section, I thought was it's what we talk about around here all the time.
I think it's, I agree. And I think the predictive nature of some of those questions, the I don't know is like an absolute no brainer. And it aligns very much with the way that we think about and really do financial planning. But I would argue that even like if it's not predictive, if a client has a question about some strategy or some method or something that you're just not sure about, like being able to say, I don't know, I'll get back to you, or I don't know and I'll reach out to somebody, a resource who would know, like I think that's valuable. And I was a little bit surprised by, I guess, you know, ego, and there's so many things that play into it, but to me, like being able to admit that is a good quality. Like being aware enough of your kind of limitations is a good thing. So I find that obviously, and if we're speculating about where the market's going to be in a year, I don't know always. But if someone asks me a question about like an estate planning strategy that I'm just not sure about, I'm not going to just like try to talk my way out of it.
I have, probably to a fault, no problem saying I don't know. Mm-hmm. And I've actually had situations where clients are like, so what is the maximum I can contribute to a 401k this year? And I'm like, I have no idea. And like, how do you not know that? You're a financial planner. And I love when they come back, because I'm like, okay, yeah, I'm a financial planner. I need to know what the tax brackets are this year, what the 529 rules are, what the Social Security rules are, how much your contribution limits are for Roth, 401ks. Like, no, I don't commit any brain space to that.
Yeah.
Because that those kind of little things change all the time. Now, if you're saying, should I max out my 401k? I can certainly help you. Let me just Google what the limits are.
Yeah.
And people don't put any, that's why I love educating people on that. Like, I'm a financial planner. I'm not a retirement specialist. And you shouldn't care that I don't know what the 401k max is this year. Are you over 50 or are you under? Like, I know that though, but I know that if you're over 50, it's more than if you're under 50.
Yeah.
And I start educating them, like, you know how much shit we need to know? So no, I don't know all those specific things, but I can get that information and apply that to your plan.
Yeah.
And that's what really matters.
That's an interesting thing to think about though, like the comprehensive nature. And I think Michael Kitz has kind of talked a little bit about this. Like the CFP is designed as a very comprehensive designation. And it's kind of the standard, we'll say, in financial planning specifically. And it's like, as a consumer, are you better off having somebody who has a little knowledge and awareness in a lot of areas, or a very defined expertise in one or two areas. And I think it's kind of conflicting because, like, we hold ourselves out as comprehensive financial planners because, right, we know enough about X, Y, and Z to be dangerous. But does that limit us in other ways? I mean, are there people, is there a market for specificity? Like, are people looking for, I'm saying people, I don't know, like for somebody who is specifically a retirement specialist? Like, is that better, worse? Does it not matter?
What does that mean, a retirement specialist? Like a specialist in helping retirees draw income the most effective way? Or a specialist in retirement plans?
Like, I'll say the former.
There's just so many avenues.
Yeah, and but when I was reading it and talking about the comprehensive part of it, you know, I sit here and I think of, okay, one individual who has a CFP holds him or herself out as a comprehensive financial planner. It's one person. Like the way we're set up, yeah. I mean, each one of us here has strengths and weaknesses in terms of their subject matter expertise, and we lean on each other all the time to take advantage of that. So I think for a firm like ours, I would bet we do a better job at being comprehensive and also specific in certain subject areas,
yeah,
because we're an ensemble of, you know, planners all with kind of our own angle.
Yeah, and we're aware enough when Meg comes to me and is like, hey, this client had this question about Social Security, and I answer it, and you're like, Jeff, I don't know if that's right or not. And I'm like, you know what? You might be right. But from there, we know where to go to get the right answer, or we know who to refer that client to get the right answer. We're self-aware enough to know we're not experts in every area. And when it comes to a 401k plan or a Medicare question or a 520, like, we engage either people at Schwab or people within our own network or people at Vanguard or CPAs that are experts in that.
Yeah.
So I read the majority of this. I liked it. I just don't think they were speaking to us as much as I thought they were speaking to us. Hmm. Like, he used the term RIA. If I was an RIA, or Mike, Michael, you're an RIA. It's like, especially when it got to the fee section, just like, I don't think you're talking to me, man, at all.
Well, they were critical of advisors who focus on the portfolio management aspect of comprehensive planning, let's say, and hold themselves out as like, that's what I do, and I do it better than, you know, the majority of others.
And for that, I charge 1%.
Yeah. And his point is, if that were really true, like if you could consistently outperform almost everyone else, you would not be working for an RIA.
Right.
And that's 100% true. But the other thing that they talked about towards the end, I don't know if Jeff, if you got this far, but talking generally about the industry and how it's still incredibly confusing, the low bar to call yourself a financial advisor, and all the other things that are still problems with respect to the way financial advising is practiced. And he had a good quote here that I thought was great. And he said, look, the only way that advisors can reliably set themselves apart in this kind of marketplace is either with extreme competence or with aggressive marketing. And that's a difficult dynamic for consumers, is what he says. And that's so true. So true. Like, and we all know the aggressive marketers. It's Fisher Investments.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And the extreme competence part, I think, is what we're aiming for. And if you're successful at doing that, I think you're gonna succeed. You know, nothing beats extreme competence.
Yeah, I guess I got defensive when he was so adamant about being against AUM fees. And I'm open to that criticism. Just what's your alternative, Jason? Because I don't want to charge someone $250 an hour because I don't like that model. I think that sucks. Like, I'm not going to like
itemize.
But I don't want to get paid $250 an hour to guide people to make decisions that could or would cost them hundreds of thousands of dollars. You know what I mean? Like, I'm worth more than that. Why do I want to get paid $250 an hour if I if I helped you make a decision or prevented you from making a decision that really hurt you financially? So I struggle with it too. Like, what's the right amount? Right? If an attorney, if you're going to go into a case in a liability claim or something like that, and you can say, okay, this attorney can win you $1 million with 90% probability you're going to win, or this one's going to win you $3 million with 20%, like, which one would you take? And why would you feel, why would you have any beef with what they charged if you're going to reap that benefit? I just don't.
I mean, I, and this might be like a little bit out of turn. The people who I've heard most critical of the AUM model are not necessarily consumers of it, right? Like, we don't have a lot of clients in our, and it gets limited, but like, who are like, oh, you should charge differently.
Then he addressed that. He said, well, that's what baby boomers, they're used to like 2% or 2.5% fees. So now that we charge under one or whatever that number is, it's a deal. You probably get more pushback from the younger people. I don't know. That's such a market we haven't explored that deeply.
Well, I think I kind of agree with you, Jeff. I think he generalizes it was 1% in 1985 and it's still 1% today. And that's not right, because the cost of everything else has come down.
He was talking about financial advice there. Financial, he said the cost of investing went down 99%.
Yeah.
Why hasn't the cost of financial advice gone down?
I would argue it has dramatically. Why? Because you get way more for your 1% than you ever did before for the right firm. Way more.
Yeah.
So I think he's off base because he's purely looking at it from the price is the price, and I think fee compression is going to happen. But fee compression happens when you have to do more for the same price as well.
And I don't understand why the price for financial planning has to go down. Why does that? You know, it only went down 25%. Well, okay. The cost of my ticket to get into the vet has, or the vet, Jesus Christ, dating myself. The link hasn't gone down. Should it? Like, why does the advice cost have to go down?
I'm with you.
Yeah, I guess because maybe there's more access now and there's more practitioners. I don't know. But that doesn't mean they're good. Like, here we are talking about how low the bar is to do this. And when there's people who do it well, we're concerned about the cost.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I would – it was interesting, that part. I know this about being an advisor, being a CFP. I mean, it takes a high school diploma ? And pass a test. It's so low. And I don't think that – I think you just need experience. Experience breeds your competency and your value in this kind of – I feel like in this kind of business. Because you can read about things in a textbook, but until you actually go through it and experience it and help a client and make a bad decision and make a mistake, and it takes – years and years of making mistakes to actually get good at something, at least to get good at this, I think it's very hard to be a good advisor if you've never spent a lot of time advising people.
Yeah, but I mean, that's probably true for most professions, right?
Sure.
Experience and applying what you've learned in the textbook to real life scenarios. Yeah, you get better at that over time.
Anything else in this that you thought was worth chatting about, Mike?
No, I think I think we're good. It was, again, very long, and I just, at least for me, those were the parts that I thought were worth talking about.
Yeah.
All right, what do we got?
NFTs.
Love an NFT.
This article is called NFTs Explained by Mitchell Clark from TheVerge.com. Mitchell's article attempts to explain NFTs, non-fungible tokens. This asset class is an evolution of fine art collecting, but with digital art coming in many forms. In recent months, NFTs have become insanely popular, with things like a digital flower selling for $20,000, and obviously I had to use the LeBron example, a LeBron James dunk clip selling for $99,000.
So I'm going to be the old guy, mm-hmm. and I don't get it. So the LeBron James clip.
Yeah.
I pay $99,000 for it. I now own that clip.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And nobody else. You can't edit it. You can't copy it. Nobody else but you. And it's verified.
I own it.
Through the whole blockchain thing.
Blockchain system. Yes.
But she can watch it whenever she wants to on YouTube.
Yeah. I mean, the game clip, yes, but not your clip.
But it's the same thing.
Yeah, but to me, this is like the whole world of collectibles, right? Whether it's baseball cards or art or a clip of a great sporting play, right? Sporting play, that's not the right word. That made me sound. Sports event, sports moment.
Whatever. Did you just compare a video clip to a baseball card?
Yeah.
Yes.
Because these are the new baseball cards.
But no one else can look at that baseball card if I own it. If I own the Mickey Mantle rookie card and it's in my possession, no one else can view it.
I can Google it.
And it can probably be counterfeited and all those sorts of things. This is like totally 100% unique. And for collectors, I'm not one of them. I don't get that at all. I'm just saying that's why people are willing to pay a lot for this piece of the internet, if you will. That's what one description was. This enables you to own a piece of the actual of call it the internet. Right, a digital something.
I don't get it. I hate to be that dumb about it, but
I don't think you're being dumb.
No,
I think you're overthinking it.
I think I'm probably underthinking it. Right? They used the example like a Monet, and there can be copies of that Monet.
Yep.
But if anyone wanted to look at the original Monet, and it's in my possession, they only get to see that original. If I allow them to see it, I can watch the LeBron clip anytime I want to. And and you could probably make the argument, yeah, but the fake Monet looks just like the original.
Mm-hmm.
I don't understand why I would ever want to own a piece of digital art that anyone else has access to and it looks exactly the same.
Well, you're using an example of the YouTube clip, which is not exactly what this person owns, right? Like the clip in its vehicle, I don't know if that's the right word, its package is not logging onto YouTube and watching a game clip. It's different. So, yes, it's viewable, but it's not in the same package that the owner owns it in. I mean, they can't like eliminate the ability for anyone else to watch that particular. And maybe that's a bad example. Maybe the sports thing is a little bit harder to like wrap our brains around. But digital art it's the Monet, right? It's like the idea that everything is unique and that you get to maintain ownership of something that is unique. It's just not paint on an easel anymore. It is a GIF or some sort of digital. I don't know.
Maybe I can't wrap my brain around it because I can't wrap my brain around art either. Like if the Mona Lisa, right, the original, I'll make up a number, is worth $1 million.
Mm-hmm.
Someone is actually willing to buy it for $1 million if I own it and I'm willing to sell it.
Mm-hmm.
But there can be another Mona Lisa fake right next, which looks exactly the same.
Yeah, but that's what we're talking about. I think the collector world, and I'm the same way as you, Jeff, is totally foreign to me.
Yeah.
But for a lot of people, it's like the most important thing in the world that they own the original and the unique and only. And I think that's what we have here.
It's just becoming digitized.
Yeah.
And now it's enabled to be spread to the speculative world of people that are coming in trying to flip their NFT for twice what they paid for it a day later. And that's that part of it's also crazy.
Yeah, I guess when I was reading this article, I could wrap my brain around it if I own that clip and no one else can view it without my permission and without paying me for it. It's like the NFL, right? They record every game that they have, and that's the NFL owns it. No one else gets to see that without paying for it.
But didn't William Shatner do something here? Did you read about him?
I did.
He's getting royalties for something. I don't know if it's Star Trek, you know, scenes or whatever. I don't even know. But he definitely is like monetizing his
dude, ownership. I don't follow anything. Didn't Shatner kill like three of his wives or something like that?
I don't think that's right, but I'm not really sure.
There's definitely some controversy around Shatner's past.
Some of the stuff I read about these tokens, it's like, yeah, I can see how like this could be a really big thing. It's only because you have this blockchain technology that legitimizes and validates and ensures that it is unique. And that has like a lot of implications for other things like title. You know, there's a title search every time property changes hands and you pay some intermediary to do that. Well, that's an area where I think this application makes a ton of sense.
Yeah.
And I mean, I don't want to keep going on the sports thing. Like, this is where that NBA Top Shot like came from, which is it's an NFT platform for NBA specific moments. And like, again, I'm not a collector. This is not appealing to me whatsoever. But you're talking about, you know, Mickey Mantle's rookie card. Like, this is the digital version of LeBron James' career. Like, if you're that big of a LeBron fan, like, you get a digital version, which I can access on YouTube, yes. But there's something unique and special and different about this version of it. And people, like, are willing to pay for that.
How much is the AI step over worth? Because I'd be interested in that, I think. Owning that. And what do I own it in? Like MP3 format? Like what?
Dude, I don't know. What do I own it in? It's a token, Jeff. It's a token.
Yeah. I think I'm too old to be able to wrap my brain around it, man.
I don't think you're too old. I just think you're not willing to like think about it.
I'm not a collector. The idea of owning something just to say I own it, I don't have that kind of ego.
Right. And it's like autographs. Like I don't get the autograph thing at all. I understand for maybe a 12-year-old, it's exciting, but for a grown adult to have a basement full of autographed like stuff,
yeah,
what?
I have a couple friends that do that.
It's so weird.
I actually think it's kind of cool. Like I wouldn't do it, but if somebody has a collection of pretty unique stuff, right? Like
that's what we're talking about. Unique.
Yeah, but it's
scared the shit out of me.
But that. Sorry. This is stuff that anyone else can go see. Like if I walked my buddy in his basement, it's finished. He's got footballs and jerseys and golf balls and this stuff signed and pictures of him with Muhammad Ali. And like, that's kind of cool to me. I wouldn't do it, but it's kind of neat. It's more physical. I can go and like that football signed by Joe Montana. No one else has that. And no one else can see it unless I let them see it or sell it to them. That's where it gets lost on me. And that's okay. Like, I'm not looking for either one of you to explain it
to
me.
Yeah, but, like, now just, like, Colin and Tyler are not going to have a basement of signed goods. They're going to have a phone with, like, digital versions of the things that they're passionate about. And that's what this – it's a different way to collect – the stuff that you're talking about that's very tangible for people who don't give a shit about touching it.
But collect it. Now, yeah. I can right-click on the Gucci Ghost and save it to my desktop, right?
I mean, probably. Yeah.
So I have it stored just like the person who owns it. That's where it gets lost on me. I think I'm out on NFTs.
Yeah.
Is all I'm saying.
I'm not surprised.
You're not surprised it gets lost on me, or you're not
That you're out.
Yeah. Downside of everything, this is written by Aaron Tang on his blog, MrStingy.com. Aaron, a self-defined optimist, writes an article about the negative outcomes that exist in life generally, but also for specific situations like finding your soulmate, choosing a career, gaining influence and fame, and even investing. His point, I think, is to try to encourage being realistic instead of overly optimistic or pessimistic.
What'd you think, Jeff?
No, don't start with me.
Okay.
No.
Why?
I had a hard time with this one. I wasn't really finding the purpose.
The purpose of the article?
I wasn't getting the point. Like, what was your point?
I think his point is there's good and bad in all decision making, and that ignoring either side is like unrealistic. It's not sustainable.
It just seemed very obvious to me. His early on example, the successful woman who was in search of a successful man, and then she finds him or he finds her, and then they realize, oh, that person works all the time, and that's why they're successful. Like you didn't realize that could be like the downside of this thing that you found, or like the guy that like spending money on people, and then the only women that are attracted to him are gold diggers. Like, you didn't think that was a
you're
possible
saying it's
downside?
Common sense, but how many examples of those things exist all the time?
How many
people are in relationships with a dynamic similar to those?
Right. It's like, I cheated on my wife with some woman, right? And like, I'm surprised that, hold on, let me rethink that example.
You're surprised that she cheats on you later?
Right,
or something
like, that. Like, duh.
Yeah.
Right? You're both cheaters. Right. Like, you didn't think for a second that my behavior might continue? And I kind of disagreed with a little, like the career thing, like,
I thought that one was spot on.
I agree with Megan on that. We've talked about this before. That I'm going to find my dream job and do what I love and have passion for it and get paid really well. It's going to be great. Well, be realistic. That's not going to happen.
Yeah.
Not only because like that really doesn't exist. Like there's so much shit to deal with any job, and there really isn't any such thing, I don't think, as a true dream job.
Dream job, no.
You know?
Yeah, I guess, unless you were like, you're, yeah.
Right. The example of getting paid to lay on the beach, that's not a job.
Right, right.
Not something that people can like aspire to do.
Lifeguards on the beach have a pretty sweet gig. But then again, like, people can die on your watch, yeah. So that would suck.
That's exactly the point of this article.
He made the point, like, every job is going to have some downsides.
Yes.
No shit, man.
But, dude, like, that, yes, it's a very common sense article, but, like, all of the things he's talking about are like things that are perpetuated by us, not us, the three of us, by this, our society. It's like, oh, just know what you want to do and you can do anything. No, you can.
Yeah.
And like, that's okay.
Mm-hmm.
Just be okay with not like having limitless opportunity. And I guess his point is that if you have that, and I think generally all three of us are very optimistic people. But there has to be a touch of like reality living in your optimism. It doesn't have to be pessimistic, but his point is like there's a downside to everything, literally the title of the article.
Yeah. I mean, one of the other sections is fame, like becoming famous. There's a massive downside to being famous.
Yeah.
And people that pursue, you know, the notion of becoming famous, I think, are out of their minds. And you know, having like huge success, you know, wealth, money, all that, without being famous, that should be the goal.
Yes.
That should be the goal.
Yes.
That part of the article resonated with me. From the standpoint, I have children who are like, I want to be Insta-famous. I want to be a YouTuber. And all they think about, but they're 12, right? So all they're looking at is this successful person and not realizing all the downside that comes with that, which is, I agree with you 100%. Very prominent, and to just be anonymous and wealthy, however you define wealthy,
right?
Because I do not define wealthy by how much money you have in the bank. That's the ultimate goal.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Literally, I want to live on an island where no one else lives there.
Someone tweeted last night about TJ McConnell. So he's a basketball player. He played for the Sixers for years.
He's a Pacer now, right?
He's a Pacer now. He had a triple-double last night. He had like 9 steals in like the first half of the game or something. But someone tweeted and was like, this man would not be recognized in any major city outside of Philadelphia. He's like a 6-man. He makes millions of dollars a year. He's just a white dude who looks like a white dude. But like, that, like, TJ McConnell is like the level of fame that you aspire to be. Like, he's very good at what he does. He gets paid a lot of money to do it. And anybody who's not a Sixers fan,
no one knows him.
Wouldn't know who this dude was from Adam.
He's the most annoying guy on the court, Mr. Hustle.
But I mean, like, it just reminded me of
this
good
example.
Okay, so our top 5 this week is top 5 switches.
Switch.
Who wants to start?
I mean, whoever's afraid there's going to be a lot of overlap.
I don't know. I'll start. I have one that's definitely not. My first one is going to be Roger Clemens leaving the Red Sox to go pitch for the Yankees.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean, arch rival.
Good to
evil. Yeah. I struggle coming up with a lot of examples, so I'm just going to use a real obvious one. It's not like I think it's great or anything. It's just really well known. It's obviously the Bruce to Caitlin.
Yeah.
Okay.
Move. Yeah. Move on from that.
It was a gender switch we're talking about, really.
I'm going to also say for my third one, Tio. You know, he's dancing on the Cowboys logo as a Niner.
Yeah.
Comes to the Birds. And didn't he get in a fight with, like, Hugh Douglas about wearing, like, a Cowboys sweatshirt or something like that on the plane?
I don't know.
Then he's on the Cowboys. So, Tio.
That's a good one.
My fourth one is, and this is a little bit of a stretch, but I'll describe it. It's Apollo Creed going to Team Rocky to train him. You know, arch rivals.
Interesting.
And he goes over to the Rocky side.
Okay. Yeah.
And then my first one is Sergei Fedorov defecting from Russia in, I think it was 1989. Unbelievably, it's an incredible story. There's documentaries about it.
Really?
He was like slinking off in the middle of the night. They came over to play like an ex. And by the way, this is back in like when you did not leave. He's in the Russian army as a hockey player. You did not, like, the penalty would have been like
death.
Yeah.
Or Serbia.
Siberia.
Wow. Yeah.
And they orchestrated this coup to get him on the Red Wings, and he ends up being, you know, Hall of Famer. But he just broke so much ground because once that was the floodgates open, you know, Russia was fair game. So
it's a very
ballsy move, but huge switch.
Very serious.
And he was like, I think, I don't know, 19 years old at the time, 20, something like that. That's my list.
It's a good one.
It is a good one.
Yeah, Meg.
All right. Mine aren't as good. MJ. Basketball to baseball?
Yeah. That counts. Yeah. That counts.
Okay. That's a good one.
Yeah.
Darth Vader?
Yeah, I thought about that.
He almost made my list. Yeah.
Kate Middleton?
No idea who she is.
She's married to Prince, not Harry, Prince, oh my God. But she's like a common person. Like she's a.
Oh, okay.
She's just a common. She's not royalty.
So went from like civilian
to British royalty.
Wow, that's a big switch.
I don't know if you guys are going to count this one. Rihanna went from music to a mogul. She's worth like $1 billion.
From her media presence?
From makeup and like lingerie and stuff.
That counts.
Yeah. I mean, that's a whole different field. Whole different, like. Endeavor.
Yeah. Okay, cool. And then my last one, and I think this one's just very clever, is Amazon. Went from a bookstore to like just a empire.
Wow. That's a really good one.
Yeah. I'm thinking about all these other. Yeah, good one.
A really good one.
Cool. Thanks.
I'm back and forth on my fifth, but I'll go with this one. Donald Trump.
Thought we weren't allowed to use politicians.
He went from a businessman to the president of the United States of America. I wasn't saying like Democrat to Republican. I just mean he was like not a politician.
Reagan?
He was
actor?
You could have used Reagan.
Yeah.
Number four is Ken Jeong.
The doctor to the actor?
Yeah. He was a physician.
Gyno, I think.
Yeah. He's a doctor. And now he's.
Is that the guy from Hangover?
He was in the trunk, the guy who popped out of the trunk.
That's a good one.
Number three is Ice Cube. He went from rapper to movie star and like a consistent movie star.
Yeah, I would argue he went from like a
gang member to rapper. Yeah. He switched a few times. Along those same lines, The Rock.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
he went from WWE to, I mean, dude, he's just done everything now.
He's like the highest paid actor.
Yeah. And my number one is Paul Marcarelli? No?
Not Do familiar. Tell.
Can you hear me now? The guy who used to be the Verizon guy and changed to the sprint guy.
That's a great. That's awesome.
That's a good one, dude.
Good one.
Yeah, that's the best one.
Yeah. I was praying neither one of you had it.
No. Oh, that was good. All right. Well, thanks for listening.
See ya
next week.